From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with local author and poet Daniel Lusk, whose latest collection is Every Slow Thing, published by Kelsey Books. Daniel Lusk is the author of 8 poetry collections and other books. His work is published widely in literary journals and anthologies, and his genre-bending essay, Bomb, published in New Letters, was awarded a Pushcart Prize. He has been visiting poet at Stranmillis University College of Queen's University Belfast, The Frost Place in Franconia, New Hampshire, and Juniata College in Pennsylvania, and a writing fellow at Yaddo and the McDowell Colony. Well known for his poetry workshops and a former commentator on books for NPR, he is now a senior lecturer of English emeritus at the University of Vermont. A native of the Prairie Midwest, he lives in Vermont with his wife, Irish poet Angela Patton. The poet Chris Salt had this to say about Every Slow Thing. This collection is beautifully crafted, exquisitely lyrical, and astutely observed. Poems of place and time that stun you with the originality of their imagery, poems of landscape, the natural world, buried narratives and dreams, pitch-perfect memories of rural childhoods, the cesarean birth of a calf, how time passes, how little we know of each other, revelations so full of mystery they speak to our nonverbal centers, as only music or abstract art can do. These are the spells and charms of a poet at the height of his powers. That again was a quote by Chris Salt about Daniel Lusk's new collection, Every Slow Thing. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Daniel about his work. I wanted to just start by talking first about the Chaucer epigraph and then about your inspiration for this collection. It's different from some of your other recent work. I'm thinking of the Vermeer Suite that we talked about in front of a live audience that time at the library.
Right.
But the epigram is, "The life so short, the craft so long to learn." And each of the sections of your book has an epigram. But I wonder if you can talk about that and then talk about the inspiration for the collection.
That little saying Angela gave to me in a frame. She had printed it at a print shop herself and gave it to me as a gift when we first got together.
So, oh, nice.
And it occurred to me that unlike the other collections that have been published, all the recent ones were based on research. Mm-hmm. The Lake book and even the Kin book, which was from, you know, living in the woods and all of the, what was there. And
right, we talked about Ken. I suspect you had to do some looking into the natural world and studying what you were seeing, maybe.
Right. I was learning about the creatures and whatnot. This one, I just because I started writing seriously while I was teaching as a poet in the schools, and I was learning the craft of poetry while I was teaching it to kids. Mm-hmm. and young people. So my whole life has been basically, while writing, learning better the craft. And I think this book is probably the most intimate of my books, really. It's the most personal. And but also I just thought it felt like that was if there was any way of seeing my craft in evidence, that would be this book.
Mm-hmm. All right. I wonder if you could read a poem. I think it's the first poem in the collection, On Goose Pond. Is that the first one? No, maybe it's
the second one, I think.
It's the second one. Anyway, would you mind reading On Goose Pond?
On Goose Pond. After a photograph by Carolyn Bates. What bird is singing on Goose Pond, this early day of cricket din and tree frog choir? Now and again, goose in residence will snore, breaking her fast, and maybe then what troubles a distant loon to sing the blues, it seems. This red, not blood on the water, but a bruised reflection of some far-off wound. That's the way it would appear. Anger, heart sore, fire in a bottle blown. And here, sweet peace for us, the mirror of whatever blow has creased the fabric of our brother world, a shimmering silence. Now and again, a bird. These murmurs on our ear of cricket, frog, and goose, mere fractals of soul-shattering sounds we might catch wind of late tomorrow, loves. Be safe. Be kind.
Thank you for reading that. I love that you do always include the natural world in a lot of your poems. You're a frog guy, I've noticed. You like frogs.
Yes.
But also, there's just some beautiful poetic words in the natural world. The cricket, I'm thinking of cricket and then fractal. Those go so beautifully together, just from the perspective of wordplay, but also just this lovely poem evokes this moment and this place. You say it's after a photograph by Carolyn Bates. So if you start with an image like that, how does this work for you, this inspiration, once you begin? If you begin with an image, do you try to respect the image all the way through, or is that tend to be like a starting point and you'll just go?
In this case, especially, it was a starting point.
Okay.
It was the mood of the photograph. So I wasn't trying to describe it. I was going back to what I already know of such a place and such a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I actually have another one that I was going to ask you to read pretty quick here, and I can't pronounce it. It's Morning in Chigila.
Chigila, yes.
In Chigila.
It's actually for Joe Fitzpatrick, who was an old friend of mine, who I learned died while we were staying with friends in Chigila, which is it's near Cork.
Okay.
It's in West Cork. And he had just died, and I was, of course, just so struck by how long we'd known each other and the fact that I was not even where I usually am when I learned of it, and couldn't attend the funeral and so on. And so I wrote this poem, which was based on the gardens and the home of the friends that we were visiting. So that's what this is. Morning in Chigila. The roof has come off the church and rain is falling in the baptistry. The metaphorical sheep of the testament graze the green sanctuary and swallows whisper over the grass. Across the way, a vault of sycamores behind a scrim of hurried lace, garment of one who will not come out from under the stone. And look, the sudden sunshine where we walked among roses and aquilegia, butterflies and lilies too, languid on the frog pond, a hymn to summer everlasting. Anon, I will take my turn at the garden gate, holding the white end of the golden thread. But now, too long away to weep, to grieve my friend, I watch the rain, the baptistry, the holy sheep, and do what I have been given to do.
Thank you, Daniel. That's just beautiful.
The place that we were staying had wonderful gardens, and it was an old farm place from the 18th century, and an even older stone building in the garden, just the shell of a house, and in the garden was an old baptistry from a church, a little place where in a high church place there would be a stand with water in it, you know, that kind of baptistry, unlike the baptistries of my childhood, which were, you know, a pool.
Right.
So anyway, that's why that stuff is in there.
Yeah. It's just lovely. I think even without the title, I would have recognized Ireland, but it's just so lovely. The golden thread, you have a few references in this collection to a gold thread or a golden thread. And also a black thread later and lace and filigree. That was interesting to me. I was wondering if that was purposeful or if each time that just served the poem.
You're right about it. I think just serving the poem. It's also that along the way of the last several years of writing, I've always been a student of folklore, and the poems are sort of in random fashion, full of little images from various folktales, they're there because I wanted the kind of basic mystery of that we all share to be evident as a kind of undercurrent in my poems.
Yeah, and I see that so clearly. This has got a lot of magic to the poems, and not just the ones in Ireland, which I think lends itself really beautifully to magic. But you have have poems from your childhood later, and there's a sense of that in there too. I wanted to mention. You write, but now too long away to weep, to grieve my friend. And that was interesting to me because there's a distance between you, but long is a word that also indicates time. So that was an interesting way to put that.
I hadn't seen him all the time that he had been ill. And so that was part of your sense is quite correct. And also that I was away. You know, I was in Ireland and not anywhere near where he was.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about writing about loss? And specifically, I think with poetry, you can write without feeling a need to explain necessarily. I mean, the poem might be something that someone like me, who doesn't know your personal history that well, might just appreciate and bring my own experience and interpretation to. How much do you feel like you need to share the details of, for example, writing about loss?
My impulse is not to write about myself or even my own experience, though, of course, I have to write from my own experience. But I'm trying to tune into what a reader might have experienced, the emotions that we all share. And I'm trying to use the tools I have to evoke, to call on those things in a reader.
Yes.
I've never had an inclination to write personal experience, but rather to see what I can, our common experience is much more important to me in my writing.
I like how you put that. I wanted to talk about the word anon. Anon is not a word you hear a lot, and I was wondering if this had to do with the building and the sense of, a place that's been there a long time. That seems like an older word.
you have a good ear. That's exactly, I mean, that's why. It's not only because I'm an old school kind of poet, but my background in religious studies and whatnot as a young person still, I think, enriches what other people might have in their lives. Mm-hmm. But it's that sense of age that I was looking for.
Okay, great. Let's see. Would you read another one? It's another morning. A morning in, I don't know how to say this one either, Glasthule?
That's exactly right. That's it's a place in Ireland, in the south east, where it's actually the Angelus and I stayed there for a month at one point, one of the trips that we went back to Ireland. It's very close to where she grew up, and also it was her mother's birthplace. Mm-hmm. And she complains kindly that I stole this poem from her because it was her mother and her
school. How dare you? Well,
so all poets steal, but I, you know, you have to steal good stuff if you want to be have good poems. So this is Morning in Glasthule. I wake to the bin men bashing the bins, lights on in clear story windows of the Herald School, sun on the slates, a fine day so far, only a rag of cloud. Magpies lording over the gardens, sparrows playing odds and evens on the wires.
Thank you. I loved that so much. The magpies lording over the gardens and the sparrows playing odds and evens. That's so perfect. They're hopping around and sometimes there's two, sometimes there's seven, you know. I love it. That was great. Hearing you talk about stealing makes me remember something that another writer said to me once. I told a story from my father's life, which I won't get into here, but it was a great story with a lot of imagery. And this author said to me, "You have 2 weeks to use that or I'm going to." I mean, writers just do. We steal from each other.
That's right. That's right.
And actually, that was great inspiration. I wrote a story, got it published. So, yay.
Good.
Now, some of this collection has to do with aging and seeing the world in a new way as time passes. There's a poem called New Year's Poem. And this is so great. I wonder if you could read that one next.
Sure. New Year's Poem. The purpose of dreams, to remind us which foot goes forward when we leap over fences and burning barricades, to warn us that upon waking, we are no longer nimble. Today, I'll stop pretending that I get to stay home and drink tea while others get dressed to go to their jobs. Perhaps the coyote will come for the last turkey hen and no one will notice. Condors and their cousins exchange secret messages when they pass on the stairs. The meaning is in the red sealing wax on the envelopes. Vermeer made sure that the pitcher in the painting would never be empty and the bowl would never overflow. My blood pressure is rising. I appear to be slowing down, but I'm approaching the speed of light.
Wonderful. You're getting to use what you learned about Vermeer when you wrote the Vermeer Suite.
Right. That's that wonderful image of the maid pouring milk into a bowl. And
right.
It's so emblematic of Holland and Vermeer.
We talked a little bit about the magic in these poems. And I liked your personification of the bird, of the animals. The coyote will come for the turkey hen and no one will notice. That's not personification. But then, you know, the condors and their cousins exchange secret messages when they pass on the stairs. The meaning is in the red sealing wax on the envelopes. I love that. I don't quite know what to make of it, I'll tell you the truth. What were you thinking when you wrote that?
I was just... I'm always interested in finding associations that the reader might have an association with. So it's an image that's just meant to evoke a sense.
It definitely does. I mean, I've never seen that before. And so it stepped right out of the poem for me.
And that sense that the buzzards that we watch, you know, when we have time to look at the sky, there seem always to be those big birds, and they seem to be climbing stairs. That was what I was looking for there. Was that
wonderful?
They're climbing.
Yes, I love it. Pass on the stairs. Oh, beautiful! I'm glad I asked. All right, so that brings us to the end of a section, not quite to the end, but that's toward the end of a section that you called Preludes. And then the next section is called No Song But Breathing. And that comes before the section that titles the collection also, Every Slow Thing. So I wonder, before you read any more, if you can talk a little bit about organizing the collection, coming up with these sections, and deciding where you would put your poems as you put it all together.
My first my first awareness of any sort of art was music. My father was a trained singer. I heard him as the staff singer on a radio station when I was a small child. And so I learned to sing almost before anything else. And that sense of wanting lines of my poetry to sing has always been there. And it was learning the craft of poetry that helped me to find that part of what I was looking for. And when I was organizing the collection, it seemed to me that as with a cantata is a musical piece that's made out of movements. And so this collection seemed to have movements, preludes, mm-hmm. you know, this middle section, which is kind of a backstory sorts of poems, context. And then the others, which are much more what some would call magical realism, mm-hmm. where I'm bringing everything I have to experiment and write poems that I really don't know how to write, except that I've got the tools to work with. So that's why the movements, I mean, that's why it has those. And even in that third movement, which is the title, Every Slow Thing, even there, I wanted it to move, to advance, to get. And that's why the sort of the old guy poems are at the end.
Yeah. all right. Well, in the second section, you have another epigram by Wendell Berry. There are some accounts that can't be settled, which is the start of that section. And then you have, I was going to ask you to read a poem called In My Hometown, which, you know, you just said you've kind of, this is backstory type of thing, this childhood recollection.
I had, as a child, by the time I went to college, I had lived in 20 houses that I could remember. My family moved around a lot, but all in the same sort of North Iowa part of the country. This is quite literally a portrait of the town where I first started to high school, a town of about 1,200 people, and a very simple sort of life in my hometown. She sits on the curbstone, picking a scab on her knee. The boys are watching haircuts through the window of a barber's caravan and pay her no mind. At the corner Rexall store, teens sit on the steps out front, sipping fizzy cream sodas and cherry Cokes. Now and again, a matronly Buick or austere Lincoln Continental ghosts by like a premonition of time to come. Coach says we are better now the season's over. If only. In the sound booth at the record store, Chet Baker plays Every Time We Say Goodbye. After the last plaint of the boozy trumpet, a little rift of silence. Like the purple aura of our mother's arms, as she tells us about a prayer circle around a neighbor's sick bed. In my hometown, life in a minor key.
Thank you so much. There's a lot that I love about this poem. You know, there's a nostalgia factor. But it's very immediate as well. Like, I just feel myself there with you on that, you know, watching the boys, watching the girl. But Chet Baker, of course, Every Time We Say Goodbye, what a nostalgic song right. to evoke, right?
Right.
You know what I loved about the description of that song And actually, this was just me making a mistake, but it's something I love about poetry, and that is going back to look at a word differently, getting something new, even just correcting an error like I did. So I read it as a little riff of silence, which I was taken with, and I thought, a little riff of silence, that's interesting. And then I went back and saw it was a rift, and then I was like, oh, that's really interesting.
In an earlier draft of the poem, it was a riff.
Oh, wow.
It was a riff. You were absolutely right. I mean, you have good ear. And that one thing that I have, I guess, unconsciously maybe strived for is that at the end of a poem, you want to either say nothing or let out your breath, you know, the kind of sense of something needs to not happen when the poem is done. So that's why the rift.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Now, I write prose, not poetry. And a lot of times you'll hear this advice that you should read your first draft with an eye to what doesn't need to be there, and that sometimes we begin our stories earlier than we should, and we end our stories later than we should. And that's just a piece of advice for revision. But I'm wondering if there's anything like that in poetry. Do you ever kind of go back and think, all right, do I need this? You know, like maybe I ended on that second to last stanza, or I don't know. Is there anything like that?
Always. But I'm also very much aware, having been a teacher for a lot of my life,
right,
of poetry, that I remember Angela showed me a poem just a day or so ago that had been submitted by somebody to a workshop for her. And I was, my suggestion was that she reverse the last two stanzas, which last two pairs of lines. And but when I first submitted my first little chapbook collection to an editor in Kansas City at Bookmark Press, he was a very good editor. And one of the things that first things that I learned from him was that in one of my poems, he said, your poem ended here.
Uh-huh.
You're already, you know, quit while you're ahead, basically. You don't need to go on with this poem. And so those kinds of things are always in my mind when I go back. And also, you know, bless the computer for being able to swap, to try out different combinations of, you know, the way the poem goes together.
Right.
Comes first, next, last. And we all, I think all poets, initially at least, have a tendency to want to wrap it up at the end. And that's a hard thing to learn, to, you know, when do you have it? When have you nailed it?
Yeah. Let's see. Do you ever take a break if a poem goes in a direction you don't like? Or is that the kind of thing that might like inspire you to just work through and keep going and push yourself more? Do you know what I mean?
If a poem isn't going anywhere, I just leave it, sometimes for months. I may find it among things I thought I would just reject and find that I did have something going. I just didn't quite have it finished. And so going back to things and reworking things is really just, for me, that's the craft. That's part of the craft. The initial impulse can only take you so far.
Mm-hmm.
And how to sustain that may come only from the reworking, as you know, from writing fiction.
Right.
Just, yeah. I'm also very much inclined, and you see it more in the later poems in the book, the more complicated ones. I keep a notebook, I've never written a journal. And that's part of that, not wanting my work to be personal or to reveal myself. Basically, I'm really shy. I've always been shy about talking about myself or revealing secrets. But I keep this notebook of things that either I happen upon something or something that I'm reading, and I most often I'm not reading poetry, I'm reading novels. I love fiction by people who really know their work, their craft. But sometimes a line will come to me that isn't in the book I'm reading. It's just something that just sort of appeared and I wrote it down. My notebooks are full of those little non sequiturs. And but if someone went back to my notebooks with my poems in hand, they would find almost all of it. All of the things from the notebooks are somewhere in some poem. And those things together with the little glimpses of your own past that appear when in the process of writing. My poems are almost never about something. They're always trying to make something that someone else can enjoy or appreciate.
Now, you mentioned your dad having been a singer and hearing him on the radio, but you have a poem in here that has some radio content, so I thought we should read that one. It's called Legacy.
Legacy. There's a little epigraph from Jill Lepore, an essay that she wrote in The New Yorker. Sometimes a whistle is all you've got. We had reasons to fear the dark. The stories we were told, not meant to comfort. How lonely to be inside that whale. The warm barn smell grown nasty after weeks on board that ark. Never mind the woman who gave herself to an enemy general and in the night drove a stake through his head, like that. We believed in a holy ghost, so tangible it could knock you down the stairs with the back of its hand. I learned to whistle when I was 7, because you never know. One time, the guy who whistled the theme for the movie, The High and the Mighty, came for a school assembly and did that for us, whistled. And with just a doorknob, a plunger, a microphone, and a pan of gravel, showed how eerie radio sound effects, creaking doors, clip-clop horses' hooves, and such were made, sheet metal thunder. We paid attention, you never know. Night also has reasons to listen up. Its languages, tree frogs, crickets, owls, screams of cats. We lock our windows, doors, sleep with a light, try not to dream.
Thank you. To me, that's a very magical poem. There's a lot of magical and kind of frightening stuff going on in that poem. I like, too, sort of noticing your infrequent but lovely rhyme schemes from time to time. So, you know, at the end there, the screams of cats and try not to dream. So you have scream and dream, but it's not at all overt. Do you ever write, I'm sure I've asked you this in previous interviews, Daniel, but I'm going to ask again, do you ever write formal poetry or not much?
No, not at all, actually. I try sometimes. In fact, there's a poem in the book, the one with the big word in the title, Concupiscence. That I was trying my very best to write a formal poem, a villanelle or a sestina or something. And the poem just wouldn't let me do that. I couldn't tie it down. I couldn't, you know, it wouldn't stay. So I did what I could with repeating a couple of lines. I like internal rhymes and I like slant rhymes when they appear, but I almost never am trying to do it. I'm writing by ear, you know, as opposed to, you know, what goes with this that you need to do with a rhyme. So
now I had two questions about this poem, but you've already answered them. One of my questions was, where did you grow up and go to school? And you've already told us that you moved quite a lot. And then my other question was, do you have journals from when you were young or do you have great recall? Because to remember all of this detail, but I was going to say something. Oh, yeah, what you said about moving a lot, that's a common theme with writers. There are writers who have, I'm trying to remember, Rose Ellen Brown is one. I think Chris Bojalian. I think it creates a maybe not for everyone, and I don't mean to presume what your childhood was like, but I think moving a lot makes it harder to make friends, which creates a sort of solitude, and you turn to words and writing and reading. That's what I always have taken from that. Was that your story, do you think?
It wasn't writing early on, but it was reading.
Yeah.
Because even as, I guess when I was about 13 or 14, I was such a shy boy that if there was a study hall, I was too shy to get up and go look for a magazine in the front.
Oh.
So I would write. We were always moving because our family would grow and we would need a bigger house or my father would get a different job. And his mental health was often troubled.
Okay.
And so sometimes he would not be able to hold a job. And so we just didn't have, we were always poor.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that taught me though was that I would always need to make a living. I would always need a job. And I started working when I was about 9 years old.
I kind of took away from some of these poems that you were in a farming family. Is that a mistake, or did you have extended family that farmed?
I had, my mother was a farmer's daughter. My grandfather was a farmer. But we often lived in the country because my mother was very good at finding houses that had been farmhouses. And so the rent was cheap.
Oh,
so
wow.
We often lived in the country, but not on a farm.
Okay.
That one poem that you're thinking about that we just mentioned, that was my uncle and aunt.
Right. I wonder, can you read, I'm a sucker for the moonwalk. I think the moonwalk may be one of my first memories, actually. I was 5 or 6, I think. I just turned 6. Could you read Dakota, 1969?
Oh, sure. At the time, I was, my former wife and I were, she was a rancher's daughter, and we were living on a cattle ranch. We went to her aunt's house to watch the moonwalk, the first moonwalk, the landing, and the power went out. And that's what prompted this poem. This is a very recent poem, actually.
Okay.
Even though it's called Dakota 1969. There's an epigraph. I like epigraphs. By Paul Simon. If you want to write a song about the human race, write a song about the moon. Call it a lace curtain or a veil. Call it a tent of hyperbole or moonlight dissolving in the kitchen. Call it a way home. In the garden of wives, there are sometimes lovers, if not for long. Larking on horseback among the prickly pear as if life is a Western and they have the world on a string. We are listening to the first moon landing on transistor radio by candlelight because on Earth's back 40, the power has gone out. Cattle are lowing in Auntie's corral, season of separation, of call and response. I wonder if the astronauts are singing hallelujah in solitary whispers under their breaths. Acoustics and helmets are terrible, they say. No crowd noise in that earth-lighted stadium. Last week, a prairie fire lit up the bedroom window like a furnace door and left 1,000 acres of pasture around the new missile silo scorched, barren as the moon we once imagined. I did not spark that sweeping conflagration, but memory has kept it burning.
Thank you for reading that. I feel like there are some poems that just have so much lovely imagery, and maybe it's being young, you know, being in just so energized by the world, you know, we just notice or recall so much imagery. But the whole thing about the energy, the power being out and listening on transistor radio by candlelight and the cattle lowing, it's so lovely. It brings us right into that.
One of the things that I meant to say earlier and you've just touched it again, was about my memory. I have My memory is better now than it was when I was younger. And maybe it's from moving all the time and being detached, unplugged from school and other things. But I have a terrible memory for information and facts. My memory is almost entirely visual. So it's like files of photographs and little video film. The things that keep coming when they come back to me, they almost always are pictures. And that's why these images are so vivid. They're actually real, remembered images, in many cases. I don't have to invent them. There they are. And so that's why it sounds like it's remembered.
That's amazing that your memory has gotten better. Maybe just being retired and not being so busy all the time. That's incredible.
Well, it is true that because I've often had jobs that were very stressful and required me to be, you know, remembering and knowing and doing according to a list of things. And now there's no stress. So here I am remembering things.
Right. I know that you're a big reader. So what have you read lately that you might recommend to listeners? And it can be fiction, nonfiction, poetry, whatever you've enjoyed lately.
I've been recently reading the novels of Louis de Bernier, and which is so rich. And it was a very difficult novel to read because it was so depressing. The Icelandic Nobel Prize winner, Halldór Laxness, which is a characterization, it's a book called Independent People, which sounds like a very prosaic title. And it's a characterization of the old Iceland and rural and cold, and you know, so if you have the heart for it, it's a wonderfully written novel. But my favorites, I think, always I go back to my favorite novella, Salman Rushdie's Harun and the Sea of Stories, and Marquez's novels and short stories, you know, The Handsomest Man in the World and The Old Man, An Old Man with Enormous Wings. Those, and I think that's because I, you know, they're that kind of magical realism that it helps me keep my ear tuned.
Mm-hmm. And then also, and with poets, I don't know if you write in terms of collections all the time. Are you writing new poetry, and are you working on a new book, or are you just working on poems, or what are you working on?
Well, I've been two things. One, I've been collecting, because I collect these non sequiturs that I make up and whatnot, for years, I submitted a group of them to a small press in India that had an open reading invitation. And so a collection of those has just been published, actually, day before yesterday.
Congratulations, that's exciting.
It's an ebook of 26 of these little things I called farthings. And they're all these sort of non sequiturs. There's a title, and then there's a one or two or maybe three line poem. And they're not haiku, they're just these. And one of the things I love is to think that, yes, they are poems. They have all of it, you know, even in such a small space. And then I've been wading my way through, Angela laughs at me because it's her fault. I've been wading through my fourth attempt to read James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Uh-huh.
And once that sense of absurdity and wordplay gets in on my ear, I've written several poems sort of using Joyce-isms as kind of the playful element of them.
Riffing, not rifting, right?
Riffing, exactly.
So, oh, that's fun. That is fun.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right. I wonder if you can read this last poem, Weights and Measures, last poem for our conversation, not for your book.
Weights and Measures. In the new year, we imagine the snow begins to sing, also the mud. We remember the sadness caught in its throat. There was war when I walked to kindergarten, and I was afraid of shadows as I went through the woods. The little rug I had to borrow at nap time had sadness in it. How many times have I slept through the birth of the 17-year locusts? How many lovers have slept beside me, waiting to leave in the morning? Because we are older now, someone will ask us to lead the way. We will try to recall a story with a lesson in it.
I loved that. I loved that ending. That place where you left us was felt perfect. And the title too, Weights and Measures. It's always interesting to me when a title kind of isn't part of the poem but changes the poem as you read it. So, but I did want to ask you a little bit about line breaks. I love studying line breaks and considering the process that a poet has followed. You know, this is just a tiny little example, but you know, your first lines are, in the new year, we imagine the snow begins to sing. And, you know, instead of in the new year, we imagine the snow begins to sing or whatever, you know, line breaks don't go where commas would go or where natural breath would go all the time. Sometimes. I've asked this question before and kind of been shut down because it's such a big question, but I want to ask it again. Not by you. You're way too polite for that. But I'm wondering if you have a small piece of advice to offer poets for insight into the process of finding your line breaks, figuring out what might be interesting or might serve the poem best.
Well, again, it's that sense of one's ear, but it's also, I'm trying to show the reader how to read the poem. And it's a matter for me, the pace of the poem is as important as anything else. It contributes so much to the tone that comes away with reading it. Mm-hmm. So it's as if it's not that I want you to read aloud. It's that if you read like I do, which is to read every word, I want it to go a certain way, a certain pace, it's more than rhythm. It's different from rhythm. It's about, you know, fast, slow, pause maybe.
And sometimes, and maybe not in this particular example, but sometimes they're quite sneaky. You know, the line break brings something to the meaning that would be completely different otherwise, which is kind of fun too.
The example that you used at first, using that first reference mm-hmm. line, that would be one of those ways to make sure that the pace is the way you wanted it and the meaning is the way you wanted it. Which words do you linger on? Which ones are stronger because of where they appear? The first line in the first word in the line or the last word in the line? Which word is it that makes, I would never end a line on a preposition, but I would probably break that rule too.
So I mean, just to take it one more, you know, to be maybe boringly specific, you know, are we imagining the new year or are we imagining the snow singing, you know, in the new year we imagine. I love that because it makes me think, wait, is it the new year or are we just imagining the new year, you know? And if you had broken the line somewhere else, we might have been thinking about other things.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's fun. I'm going to mention again, the name of the collection is Every Slow Thing, poems by Daniel Lusk, published by Kelsey Books. And I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org, this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Daniel Lusk about his new book, Every Slow Thing, published by Kelsey Books. You can learn more about his work at carrigbin.com, the website that he shares with his wife, Irish poet Angela Patton. That's spelled CarrigBinn.com. You can also find earlier interviews with Daniel on my podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider what Daniel called his farthings, tiny zen-like poems that share wit, irony, natural beauty, and wisdom. Here are a few of his that he kindly shared with us. Sepals, as if priests were magpies and souls were shiny objects, as if brothels were little seminaries of corporeal art. After the storm, and Noah sent forth birds, voiceless gestures over the fathomless silence in search of something that might be said. Lyric. Listen, there is saffron on the poet's bow. So these are three of Daniel Lusk's farthings from a new collection that's just come out. I will list these on the podcast site. Again, these are thanks to Daniel's generosity, as well as a link to the publisher that recently put out this collection called Farthings. See if you can come up with a few of your own. They're kind of fun. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts. Like it on Facebook and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I want to tell you about a new book festival that's taking place in Burlington, Vermont in September. The Green Mountain Book Festival will take place in downtown Burlington from Friday, September 23rd through Sunday, September 25th. It's going to be a really exciting festival. The headliner is Ruth Ozeki. I will be saying more things about this in coming weeks, but just put it on your calendar, September 23rd through the 25th. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.